detailed, than any he'd managed before. He described the black man as having a heavy, square face with baby fat on the cheeks, short, kinky hair, flared nostrils, thick lips, light brown skin, and a thick neck which would have taken a 16.5 or 17 shirt collar. The taller of the two white men had been stocky and muscular, with a tall face, high forehead, short, clean, light brown hair, and a muscular weightlifter's neck. His eyes had been vacant, but he had been good-looking nonetheless. A clean-looking guy, MacDonald said, with a strong jaw and a dimple in the center of his chin, approximately 3/8 of an inch in length. In addition, he had worn a light tan windbreaker and a cross, about 1.5 inches long, on a fine chain around his neck. The shorter white man had been an Italian with greasy hair and a bad complexion. His face had been pie-shaped. He'd had a thin pencil mustache, nasty ferret weasel eyes, as well as a weak chin and skinny neck. He'd worn a gray sweatshirt with pockets in the front and had looked wasted, like a doper. The female, too, had been weak-looking, with a pointed chin and long, straggly, unkempt blonde hair. Her face had been almond-shaped. Her nose had had a bump on it, and she'd spoken in a wasted, monotone voice with an unpleasant, medium-high pitch. Her right eye had been shaded by a light tan or off-white oyster color hat, which had been made of felt. The brim of the hat had been floppy and about 15 or 20 inches across. On the videotape, MacDonald then reenacted the attack. "What are you doing here?" he shouted to the intruders. "What the hell is going on? What the fuck are you people doing here? What are you assholes doing in my house? Get the fuck out of here, you assholes." Then, having heard his daughter scream, "Daddy, Daddy, 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 Daddy," he shouted, "Kimmy, I'll help you." His narration continued. "I'm trying to push them away. They're pulling me to the end of the couch by my shirt. I'm all bound up. My arms are all wrapped up. I can't do anything. I'm still trying to kick the fucking blanket off my feet. I can't do anything. My hands aren't free. I can't do anything well. They're punching me in the chest. My head hurts. I've got someone's hand. I saw a blade. The fucking pain isn't a punch. I got stabbed. My fucking pajama top is wrapped all around. I can't free my arms. Fuck! Someone hit me with a club. I don't know what to do. I've got to get my hands free. I've got to keep them away. Acid is groovy. Kill the pig. It's all I hear. No sounds. Acid is groovy. Kill the pig. They're going to kill me. I can't keep holding on. I can't keep holding on. I can't do it. Fuck! I'm sliding forward. I see a knee. A bare knee. My arms, they're so heavy. I can't get them up. I can't get them up." Later, in a voice so distraught, so filled with pain and desperation that even the forensic psychiatrist began to cry, he recounted what had happened after he had regained consciousness, giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to Colette. "The air is coming out of her chest. It's not working." Observing Kimberly in her bed, "She looks bloody, too. She's my little girl. She looks funny. She looks dead." And then Kristen. "Christy, you'd better be okay. She looks pale. She doesn't look good. She doesn't look like she is breathing." Toward the end, he described his final circuit through the house, returning first to Colette and lifting the pajama top he had earlier placed across her chest. "I hugged her. I told her the kids would be okay. I'm kneeling next to her. I want to see if her chest looks as bad as I first saw it. I put the pajama top back. I decide to check the kids one more time. I've got to check Kimmy. Kimmy is my little girl. I've got to go see her. Kimmy is limp. Kimmy looks terrible. I pick her up. My left hand is under her shoulder, picking her up. My right arm is under her neck. I give Kimmy mouth to mouth. It doesn't feel right. The air must be escaping. I can't help her. I check her femoral pulse. There's no pulse. I pick up her bedclothes and lay them on her and go see Christy. I have to see Christy. Christy has got to be okay." the emotional impact of the tape, particularly on those not intimately familiar with the facts of the case against McDonald, was overwhelming. If he's guilty, the psychiatrist said, he deserves an Academy Award. To the immense chagrin of Bernie Siegel, however, the jury never got to see the videotape. Indeed, the jury was not even permitted to hear from Dr. Sadoff or from the North Carolina psychiatrist because of Judge Dupree's ruling, issued after McDonald had submitted to examination by a psychiatrist and a psychologist employed by the prosecution, that such testimony was irrelevant in a case where the insanity defense was not being employed, and given the likelihood that the prosecution and defense psychiatrists would tend to contradict one another, that their testimony would be less than illuminating. The broad question of whether or not it is open to the defendant to bring in an expert opinion that his character is such that he probably would not have committed a crime such as this is a very, very close question, the judge said. There is some good argument to be made on both sides. It is my own conviction, he added, that to pit shrink versus shrink would simply tend to prolong the case and at best would prove something that would just tend to confuse the issues. The law on this, while certainly not settled by any stretch of the imagination, is not such as to allow the evidence to be admitted. And rather than let things run to Christmas, I would just as soon stop it now and wonder the rest of my life, which I would allot about 3 seconds to this, as to what they would have said. During the fourth week of trial, however, the jurors did hear from Paul Stombaugh of the FBI laboratory. He was a 52-year-old former football player from Furman College who had spent 25 years in the FBI before his retirement in 1976. For the last 16 of those years, he had worked in the FBI laboratory in Washington and had testified as an expert in hair, fiber, bloodstain, and fabric analysis in more than 300 criminal cases in 48 of the 50 states, and had appeared as an expert witness before the Warren Commission's investigation into the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Unlike his grand jury appearance, at which he had been encouraged to articulate his theories, at the trial, Stombaugh was restricted to fact. Even so, his testimony was considered by many observers to be the most damaging to McDonald of any given at the trial. It was through Stombaugh that the prosecution first informed the jurors of the following: that the cuts made in the pajamas worn by Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen McDonald had been made by the sharp, straight old hickory knife, and not the dull, bent Geneva Forge knife; that the cuts in Jeffrey McDonald's torn blue pajama top had been made by the Geneva Forge knife; that no cut in the pajama top corresponded to the location of the chest wound which had caused the puncture of Jeffrey McDonald's right lung; that the pajama top had been torn down the left front seam and down the left sleeve in a manner which indicated that someone standing in front of Jeffrey McDonald had ripped it as he spun away, and not, as he had told investigators, that it had either been torn over his back as he had fought with intruders, or that he had torn it from his wrists himself as he had entered the master bedroom; that the top had been stained by Colette McDonald's blood in at least 4 locations before it had been torn; that the 48 puncture holes in the pajama top were perfectly round, with no tearing around the edges, indicating that they had been made while the top was stationary, and not while McDonald was using it as a shield to fend off an ice-pick-wielding intruder; that bloodstains on the Hilton bath mat corresponded with the shape and dimensions of the old hickory knife and the ice pick, indicating that someone had either rested them or attempted to wipe them on the bath mat before discarding them out the back door; that bloodstains on the sheet found on the master bedroom floor matched impressions made by the bloody sleeves and cuffs of both Jeffrey's and Colette's pajamas, indicating that persons wearing those garments had come into direct contact with the sheet while the garments were still wet with blood; that the sheet also contained bloody handprints, and, in blood, the outline of a bare human shoulder; that when the pajama top was folded as near as possible to the way it was folded on top of the body at the time the photographs were taken, 21 holes were discernible in the top layer of the garment, and that these fell into a grouping, 16 on the left side and 5 on the right, which was consistent with the grouping of 16 ice pick holes on the left and 5 on the right side of Colette MacDonald's chest. And further, that the remaining holes in the garment could be aligned with those top 21 in a manner which indicated that it would have been possible for someone to have made all 48 with 21 thrusts of an ice pick, the same thrusts that had made the ice pick holes in Colette's chest. Understandably, Bernie Siegel did not go quietly into the dark night toward which Stambaugh's testimony was leading. At a press conference called even before he began his cross-examination, Siegel termed Stambaugh's conclusions shocking and totally without foundation, and said, "Excuse the pun, the biggest fabrication I have ever seen." Any scientific organization to which Stambaugh might have belonged, Siegel said, should throw him out on the basis of his testimony at the trial. Judge Dupree was less than charmed by Siegel's outburst, particularly when, the next morning, Siegel, at the bench, objected that the government was taking too much time to conclude Stambaugh's testimony, and by repetitious questioning and use of charts and photographs to illustrate Stambaugh's words, improperly attempting to persuade the jury that Stambaugh's opinions had a scientific validity, which he felt they lacked. "They keep putting repeat copies of the same thing, so just in case, somehow in their closing arguments, they don't mention it 50 times, they will have mentioned it 55. Now, Your Honor, you have repeatedly told me that I cannot argue with government witnesses. I cannot argue my case. Why is he being allowed to make argument?" "Wait a minute," Judge Dupree said. "Are you insisting on a right to argue with the witness?" "No, Your Honor." "Or with counsel during the trial of the case in open court?" "No, Your Honor. But what I ask for, I just wanted to know if I had misunderstood the proprieties of the situation." "The proprieties are, Your Honor, my feeling is that Your Honor has found that when I put questions to the government's witnesses, we are told it is improper to argue with the witnesses, that the time to argue my case would be at the end. Now, what the government does, they have 10 photographs, exact duplicates of each other. They keep putting them up, attaching them to exhibits. They're showing the jury for the umpteenth time another copy of the same photo. That is duplicitous. It is repetitious. It has been in evidence more times than any of us can count, and I object. It is not fair to permit that. It is misleading, and I am saying there ought to be a limit at some point." "Well, Mr. Siegel," said Judge Dupree, "if the Lord lets me, I am going to treat both sides equally in this case. I am going to let both sides have a full and fair hearing and develop their cases exactly like they want to. You are going to be fed out of the same spoon. That is the rule that obtains at all times in this court. I'm going to give you all the time that you need. We have spent too much time in this case here now to be talking about duplicity. You spent 45 minutes yesterday afternoon qualifying or trying to disqualify the witness here. And then you held a press conference, apparently, and expostulated further on his lack of requirements. And it appeared on the front page of the paper this morning. I am not complaining about that, but I am saying, as far as giving you the full opportunity to develop whatever you want to do, I am doing that for you, and I am doing that for him. And while I'm at it, for whatever it's worth, and I say this to both of you, when lawyers give interviews to the press, it has been my observation over the years that lawyers who are entirely confident of their position and who believe in the correctness of their cause eschew that kind of thing. To me, it just telegraphs some weakness. As far as the jury is concerned, I am hoping that they are observing their oath and are not reading anything. There is always the possibility, though, that they will. Therefore, while I don't want to muzzle anybody, I don't see why we can't stick to our knitting here in the courtroom. I don't give a damn what appears in the paper myself, but when it is on the front page, they can't escape it. They had on yesterday's front page verbatim quotations as to how the defense was going to destroy some witness, Stambaugh, probably, and all that stuff. Here again, I don't run lawsuits. I sat out there 34 years and I saw a lot of judges that came to town and professed to know more about my case in 2 hours than I had been able to learn in 3 or 4 years of living with it. So I wouldn't do that. I'll let you run your case. But for whatever it is worth, I'll say that I think talking to newspapers while the trial is in progress as to what you are going to do with your evidence and so forth, I think it may come very close to transgressing the roles of professional responsibility in ensuring a fair trial for both sides. When Siegel did begin his cross-examination, however, it was with a further attack upon Stambaugh's credentials. He had subpoenaed Stambaugh's undergraduate records from Furman College. He asked Stambaugh if he had ever taken a physics course while in college. Stambaugh said that he had. "And that was the course you got a D in, isn't it, Mr. Stambaugh?" Siegel shouted. As government attorneys loudly objected, Judge Dupree instructed the jury to disregard Siegel's remark. "Your Honor," Siegel said, spinning to face the judge, "this man has been qualified as some kind of pseudo-expert. I want to find out..." "Objection!" Brian Murtaugh shouted. "I want to know whether he has any basis for making the statements he has made," Siegel said. "Now wait a minute," said Judge Dupree. "If you have any arguments to make, you make them here at the bench. I will make them wherever Your Honor will decide they should be made," Siegel said, with an air of exaggerated politeness that bordered on insolence. "Well, I just said, right here at the bench." Judge Dupree then turned to address the jury. "Members of the jury," he said, "counsel has just made a statement to the effect that this witness has qualified as some kind of pseudo-expert. The court considers that that comment was improper. The court can understand that counsel, as I've told you before, may in the heat of battle sometimes say things that on further reflection they might not have said. I ask you, however, to disregard that comment. It will be for the jury to determine whether or not this witness is an expert. As the court has said, the evidence tends to show that he is. It will also be for the jury to determine what weight, if any, his testimony is to be accorded." By now, Bernie Siegel had reached the bench, where Judge Dupree told him, "I have apologized for you about all I am going to before this jury. I don't want your client to be prejudiced before this jury by outbursts such as this last one you made. I have an obligation to look after him as well as everybody else in this case, and I want to see that it is done. If you have got any outbursts to make, or if you want to make any argument, come up here." Siegel's cross-examination, however, continued in a bitter, sarcastic vein. Focusing on Stambaugh's assertion that one of the bloodstains on the sheet could have been made by a bare shoulder, Siegel said, "As a matter of fact, don't almost all of us have some kind of very fine hair on our shoulders?" "That is right." "Did you find any hairlines on that smear?"
"No, sir."
"Did you look for any?"
"Yes, sir."
"How did you look for them?"
"With a magnifying glass."
"Ah," said Siegel, stepping backward and raising his eyes toward the ceiling in mock astonishment. "We have a scientific instrument here."
"Objection!" shouted Jim Blackburn.
"All right," Siegel said sharply, glaring toward Blackburn. "It's not a scientific instrument."
"Objection!"
"Members of the jury," Judge Dupree said wearily, "disregard the comment of counsel about the magnifying glass. In regard to the bloodstains on the sheet that Stambaugh had said were made by the pajama cuffs, Siegel said in an accusatory fashion, "You just took the cuff and you took the bedsheet and you looked at them side by side. Is that what you did?"
"I did a little more than that, sir. I sat down and studied the stains for long periods of time."
"Did you say study?"
"Studied them, compared them, examined them, things of this nature. A direct comparison to locate the area on that cuff that corresponded with that stain."
"Studied," Siegel said scornfully. "How did you study it? By looking at it?"
"Looking at it," Stambaugh agreed.
"Compared. How did you do that? By looking at it?"
"Direct comparison."
"Yes, sir."
"Well," Siegel said, his voice suddenly rising to a shout, "every word that you've used,
every adjective. That meant only that you looked at it, and you looked at it, and you looked at it. Is that right, Mr. Stambaugh?
That is correct.
If the jury then gives these items the same attention, they will be able to do exactly what you were able to do. Is that right, Mr. Stambaugh?
Perhaps.
There is no secret scientific method that you used that they are not aware of, is there? That you haven't told us about?
No, sir.
It is just looking, Siegel screamed. That is what your fabric impression testimony is about. Just looking.
I believe that is what I have testified to, Stambaugh said. It was undeniably far from what Victor Warheide had told Dr. Sadoff while the grand jury had been in session, that the field of fabric impression study was the scientific equivalent of fingerprint analysis. But the jury would not be concerning himself with what Victor Warheide had said 4 years earlier. The jurors would be interested only in whether, to them, the stains on the bedsheet appeared to have been made by the bloody cuffs of Jeffrey and Colette MacDonald's pajamas. Toward the end of his cross-examination, Siegel tried to invalidate the pajama top reconstruction. Now, you told us yesterday, Mr. Stambaugh, that you did not really do this little demonstration with the pajama top exactly the way it was on Mrs. MacDonald's body. Isn't that what you told us yesterday?
No, sir. We folded it. Did you say that or did you not say it yesterday? Siegel interrupted sharply.
Then you can explain as long as you want.
Object to comments of counsel, Brian Murtaugh said.
It is not a comment to tell a witness he can answer, Siegel said. Your Honor, I resent that. It is not a comment to say that I will give him all the chance to answer a question. It interrupts cross-examination needlessly.
All right now, Judge Dupree said. If you have some objection to make, the customary way to do it is to come up here. I will not take any lectures from counsel from either side. If there is an objection and you want to be heard, we will hear it at the bench.
My response, Your Honor, Siegel said, without taking as much as a single step toward the bench, is I do not think I was making a comment when I said I would give the witness a chance to answer. There was an objection before the court. I was prepared to rule on it, but we had another lecture superimposed on the subject.
I apologize, Siegel said.
That is what I am calling to your attention.
I did not mean to do that.
Restate your question, and we will let the witness answer.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me just regather my thoughts.
After a short pause, Siegel continued.
Do I recall you correctly, Siegel continued, as having told us yesterday that you did not fold the pajama top in the demonstration exactly the way it appeared in the photographs?
We folded the pajama top as close to it as we could.
That is the most you are willing to say about the way you folded it for your demonstration?
And when we folded it that way, then we observed 21 holes in the top.
Before we get to the holes, I just want to understand whether, when you finished folding it, you think you got a fairly good replica of the way the garment was laid over Mrs. MacDonald's body.
Yes, sir. I feel we did the best we could.
Well, doing the best you could, is that the same as being a pretty good replica?
I would say so.
Is that the strongest statement you are willing to make in support of the way the garment was folded? That, you think, is the best you could do with it?
Working with what we had, we did the best we could.
Well now, tell us some of the ways in which your experiment in folding is really different from the photographs.
Mr. Siegel, I have been answering your question, the same one over and over, the only way I can answer it. We folded the pajama top the way it appeared in the photographs. We found 21 holes in the surface. The question was, could those 21 holes on top be lined up with the 48 holes? Could this be done? And we...
Didn't you just simply tell them, Mr. Stambaugh?
Siegel interrupted.
Of course you can take any 48 holes and put them in 21 holes. That this is not a scientific experiment. Did you ever tell them that?
Objection, Brian Murtaugh said.
Objection sustained, said Judge Dupree.
Sustained objections notwithstanding,
Jeffrey MacDonald was exuberant by the time Siegel had finished. Stambaugh's the reason I'm here, MacDonald said later that day. Him and Brian Murtaugh. And Bernie just absolutely destroyed him. You've just seen their smoking gun turn into a piece of shit. If the judge had any balls at all, he'd throw the whole case out right now. He wouldn't even make us put on our defense. In private, Siegel raged against the judge in the vilest terms imaginable. He raged against Republicans, of whom Judge Dupree was one. He raged against the South. He raged against the U.S. Army and the FBI and the U.S. Supreme Court. All those forces that had conspired to present Judge Dupree with this opportunity to exercise his malevolence. Siegel seemed to bear no less antipathy toward Brian Murtaugh. While it was Jim Blackburn, the courtly young Southern gentleman, who had been presenting the bulk of the prosecution case, it was Murtaugh, Siegel's adversary from grand jury days and surrogate for and successor to the Grand Inquisitor, Victor Warheide, who had been besting Siegel in argument on the evidentiary points before Judge Dupree. Early in the trial, Dupree had noted the depth of bitterness which seemed to exist between the two men, and had called them both to the bench to issue a warning. "The reason I want you both up here," he had said, "is because it has been apparent to me from the very first time that the two of you appeared in this court that there was a certain amount of friction and animosity between you. I quite understand. I sat out there for 34 years. In the dog days of August and during the third week of a trial, you may spurt off something that you, on reflection, would not have done. You did that yesterday," he said to Siegel. "You were just about to do it again today, and I must say, and this applies to both of you, I am not going to have it. The thing that I am apprehensive about is this. One or the other of you, if you show these displays of temper and hostility and animosity, are going to prejudice your client. I am here to see that this trial is conducted fairly, and I am not going to tolerate its being tried in a climate of hostility for either side. We are going to try it calmly." "It ain't your case," he said to Siegel, and, turning to Murtaugh, "it ain't yours. It belongs to the parties in the case, and you are just here in a representative capacity, both of you, and I am expecting both of you to so conduct yourselves. The last thing I ever would do, if I could avoid it, would be to embarrass a lawyer in front of a jury and his client. But if I have to do it in order to maintain order in this court and conduct this trial like it is supposed to be, then that is what I am going to do." Following that lecture, Siegel, for at least a few days, seemed to keep his distaste for Murtaugh under tighter control, at least within the confines of the courtroom. But as Dupree ruled against him time and again, and as his bitterness and frustration grew, Siegel, who had been described as the picture of confidence in one newspaper account only a few days earlier, began to vent spleen in the press. And since it would have been grossly inappropriate and counterproductive to make public some of the private opinions he held regarding the attitude of Judge Dupree, it was Brian Murtaugh who became the focal point of Siegel's public outrage. "What I dislike with considerable intensity," he told one reporter, "is that Murtaugh is an anonymous, faceless little man who in the outside world would be of very little consequence to anybody's life. But he, as a bureaucrat, is suddenly draped with the power of the whole United States government, and people act as if he is a person with the judgment, intelligence, and maturity to be taken seriously." Murtaugh, at 32, was just as thin and sallow, his hair was just as lank, and his manner was just as acerbic as it had been 5 years earlier when Jeffrey MacDonald had called him a little creep and a viper who did not know any of the social graces. Murtaugh's sense of moral outrage that MacDonald had not yet been convicted and imprisoned had grown even greater over the years. He had accompanied Paul Stambaugh to the cemetery in September of 1974 and had gazed into the open coffins at the physical remains of Colette and Kimberly and Kristen. And the memory of what they had been then, as compared to a vision of what they might have been had they been permitted to live, was not one which would ever fade. He chose not to respond to Siegel's attacks. "I just don't deal with Bernie if I can avoid it," was all he said. At a surprise party at the Kappa Alpha House, the occasion being Bernie Siegel's 49th birthday,
The highlight was the presentation to Siegel of a set of darts and an enlargement of a recent photograph of Brian Murtaugh. One by one, each member of the defense team took a turn throwing darts at the picture. Jeffrey McDonald scored a direct hit. He cheered for himself as his attorneys and their assistants clapped and laughed. In high spirits, he seemed oblivious to the possibility that, under the circumstances, it might not have been appropriate for him to be propelling a sharp, pointed object toward even the photographic representation of a human being. McDonald's buoyancy might have been lessened even further had he been aware of the private remarks which a criminologist, hired by the defense as an expert witness, had made to Bernie Siegel after having learned of Paul Stombaugh's findings. "This is very convincing evidence," the paid expert said, referring to Stombaugh's pajama top reconstruction. "Now I see why they got the indictment." Siegel attempted to be dismissive, discoursing at some length about how even the government's own theory of the crime offered no plausible explanation for why McDonald would have placed his pajama top on top of his wife's chest before stabbing her with the ice pick. The criminologist simply shook his head. "You can raise all that, Bernie, but this is like a fingerprint. Holy Christmas, that's very convincing stuff, Bernie. I'm not an attorney, but after seeing this, my advice to you," and here he leaned forward and gave Siegel an avuncular pat on a pinstripe knee, "is to get as much as you can into the record for appeal." Over Siegel's strenuous objections, the jury visited 544 Castle Drive. On a very hot and very sunny August morning, a day as different from February 17, 1970, as a day could be, the 12 somber, silent men and women, and four alternates, filed through the musty, cramped space in which Colette and Kimberly and Kristen McDonald had been clubbed and stabbed to death. Jeffrey McDonald, wearing a dark, heavy, pinstriped suit despite the heat, also re-entered the apartment for the first time since he'd been carried out on a stretcher 9.5 years before. He had no role to play, no function to perform, but Bernie Siegel wanted to be sure that the jurors were aware that no sense of guilt prevented McDonald from returning to the scene of the crime. Afterward, he stood outside in the company of Siegel and Wade Smith. A group of perhaps 100 had gathered behind barricades erected by the military police. As the jurors re-entered the van that would carry them back to Raleigh, and as McDonald prepared to return to Wade Smith's station wagon, he was surrounded by a throng of excited housewives and smiling children who called out words of encouragement. Some of the children even rushed forward to shake his hand. Like a baseball player signing autographs on his way out of a stadium, McDonald worked his way slowly toward the car. It was the first time in 9.5 years that he had made physical contact with a child on Castle Drive. "It was nice," he said, once he was inside and the air conditioning had been turned on. He appreciated such signs of support. The children waved at him as he departed. Back in court, the prosecution played a tape recording of the April 6, 1970 interview. This was an event which marked for more than one member of the jury the end of the presumption of innocence. "Until I heard that," a juror would comment later, "there was no doubt in my mind about his innocence. All the evidence had just seemed confusing. But hearing him turned the whole thing around. I began to look at everything in a whole new way. There was something about the sound of his voice, a kind of hesitation. He just didn't sound like a man telling the truth. Besides, I don't think someone who just lost his wife the way he said he did would have sat there and complained that her kitchen drawers had been a mess. There was a cockiness," another said. "Arrogance when there should not have been arrogance. It was so different than what I think my own attitude would have been under the same circumstances that it just started me wondering what kind of man he really was. After the tape, I started to believe he could have done it. And once you start to believe that, with all the evidence the government had, it's not a big step to believing that he did it." And then came the day on which Mildred Kassab testified. For a while, she had attended every session of the trial. Then the judge had ruled that anyone who would later be called as a witness would not be permitted in the courtroom prior to testifying. After that, Mildred spent her days in a small apartment just a few blocks from the courthouse that she and her husband had rented for the duration of the trial. With the shades pulled low against the heat and the steady hum of air conditioning in the background, she resumed writing in the journal she had begun years before, forcing up the memories, even the worst of them, as a means of preparing herself to testify. March 18, 1964. Jeff called us. Kimmy was born. Colette's narrow hips were not meant for babies. She was torn and exhausted before they did a cesarean. But the moment I walked into her hospital room, she lifted the infant from her breast and said, "Here, Mom, here is one of your lost little girls." I had to leave Monday morning. I had an appointment made some weeks earlier to redecorate a funeral home, Kemp's, he buried them in 1970, and had to meet workmen there. Jeff took me to the train in Princeton. I said, "Take care, I'll be back on the 5 o'clock train tomorrow." He looked so proud standing there, a new father. He only stood until the train pulled out and then drove into New York to meet his girlfriend. So the great deception began. She wrote of her life after the murders. The hunt for her letters, looking at movies and slides to hold on to our memories, the feverish planting of roses and more roses, the pictures losing their meaning and becoming only pictures, holding on to a dream, tiptoeing through the day to try to keep the dream alive, to no avail. The first couple of years, looking through the fence at the 5-year-old and 2-year-old children next door, then finally borrowing them for hours at a time, someone to shower with all that bottled-up love. It didn't work, though. The 2- and 5-year-olds became 6 and 9, and fantasy ended. Keeping our lives separate from others because our grief contaminated those who were too close to us. Their lives must not be infected by our feelings. Freddie's company moving from New York to New Jersey, but I could not think of moving, of leaving them behind. Living on with Freddie coming home weekends because I couldn't move away and leave them, and all of the memories stored in the rooms of that house, they were still there. I wanted every stitch of clothing they ever owned, down to the last torn sneaker. No one else should get to wear those poor, shabby, personal things. I kept every single thing, too, until 16 months ago, when we moved to a smaller house. I still have a few things from each one that can recall a day or an event we shared. A doll of Christie's, Kimmy's little purse from the jacket she wore last, with $2 in it, a couple of colored shells, the beauties of the world they would never see, the music they would never hear, the sunsets and the mornings, watching the bird feeder through my binoculars and seeing a pair of courting blue jays strutting and posturing beneath the rhododendron bushes with the sun just rising through the trees, all so achingly beautiful, and they would never know. I think the reason I have kept my mind all these years is because my greatest grief has been for Colette and her poor, poor life with him. Forgetting my own pain and realizing hers, I pray she knows he is being given some punishment, however small and unbalanced it is. The next day, from the witness stand, when asked on cross-examination by Bernie Siegel if it were not true that she had become somewhat preoccupied by the subject of her daughter's murder, Mildred Kassab replied, "Of course. Wouldn't you be?" She also said, "I devoted 6 years of pregnancy to having Colette, so I can certainly devote 9 years to finding her killer." From the first days at Kappa Alpha, Jeffrey McDonald's own mother was a highly visible presence. The 9.5 years of sorrow and fear had rendered her high-strung and gaunt, but her energy and cordiality remained undiminished. Whether her task for the day was to drive her son to court in the morning, to take his suits out for dry cleaning, to aid or sometimes supervise Siegel's student assistants in the downtown office, to replenish beer, wine, and snack food supplies, or simply to listen sympathetically to the defense's account of what sort of day it had been in court, like other witnesses scheduled to testify, she was prohibited from attending trial sessions, she performed with relentless vigor and a cheerfulness which, under the circumstances, seemed almost as remarkable as her son's expressed certainty that the case could not be lost. When her time to testify did come, Dorothy MacDonald impressed all who saw her as a warm, gracious, and courageous human being, the same impression she had made on those who had known her in Patchogue when the MacDonald children were growing up, on those with whom she'd come in contact as a frequent companion to Jeff and Colette after their marriage, and upon all those, including Franz Joseph Grebner, Victor Warheide, Brian Murtaugh, and now Jim Blackburn, with whom her life had been at cross purposes since her daughter-in-law and grandchildren had been murdered. No witness, himself included, did more to help Jeffrey MacDonald's cause. Indeed, one juror even remarked after the verdict had been announced that, "I think she swayed many jurors with her talk of the love that had existed between Jeff and Colette. By the time she finished," this juror said, "I know that my mind had been changed." In addition to Dorothy MacDonald, Siegel called to the stand more than a dozen other character witnesses. Their composite testimony was that MacDonald was a peaceful, truthful, honorable man who not only had dearly loved his wife and children, but who had turned out to be a skilled and compassionate emergency physician at St. Mary's Hospital in Long Beach. Jim Blackburn did not dispute these assertions. Of most character witnesses, in fact, he asked only a single question. Were you inside 544 Castle Drive between the hours of midnight and 4 a.m. on February 17, 1970? As each replied in the negative, Blackburn nodded politely, turned away, and said, "I have no further questions, Your Honor." Siegel also called a mystery witness, a man from Roanoke, Virginia, who in February of 1970 had lived within 100 yards of Castle Drive, and who said now, 9 1/2 years later, that at about midnight on Monday, February 16th, while sitting in his apartment gluing a model plane together, having recently returned from a tour of duty as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, he had seen 2 white men and 1 white woman with long blonde hair, all wearing sheets and all carrying candles, walking past his doorway toward Castle Drive. There was no doubt that his story was intriguing. It might have been considerably more serviceable, however, if he had told it to investigators on February 17, 1970, rather than waiting 9 1/2 years. The witness, whose name was James Milne, said the reason he had not mentioned it before was that no one had bothered to ask. The prosecution did not seem unduly alarmed by Milne's highly publicized appearance. "I don't know that there weren't 3 such individuals, Brian Murtaugh remarked. "They could have been coming home from choir practice." His implication was clear. The essence of the case against MacDonald remained what it had been from the beginning, what was found inside and not who had been seen outside, 544 Castle Drive. In an attempt to combat this, Siegel called a series of witnesses who qualified as experts in the field of criminology. Chief among these was John Thornton, a quiet, bearded, pipe-smoking professor from the University of California at Berkeley. Thornton had been ballyhooed to the press by the defense as our Stambaugh, but his time on the stand turned out to be an unexpected bonus for the prosecution, and also provided the center stage highlight of the summer for Siegel's nemesis, Brian Murtaugh. Thornton, as anticipated, disputed Paul Stambaugh's contention that bloodstains on the sheet found on the master bedroom floor formed the impression either of hands or of a bare human shoulder. Unexpectedly, however, he conceded that other impressions clearly were those of the cuffs of Jeffrey and Colette MacDonald's pajama tops. Bernie Siegel tried to explain to reporters that this admission had not been as damaging to the defense as it appeared. "No one can prove when those impressions were made," Siegel said. "They're just another of the meaningless facts that exist in this type of complicated case." When Thornton resumed his testimony, however, he provided the context for an incident, the implications of which
no amount of explanation could neutralize. Thornton's central contention was that Stambaugh had been incorrect in his assertion that the absence of tearing around the 48 holes in the pajama top indicated that the top had been stationary at the time the holes had been made. To substantiate his claim, Thornton cited the result of a laboratory experiment he had performed in California, wrapping cloth identical in composition to the pajama top, 65% polyester and 35% cotton, around resilient material, then stabbing through the cloth with an ice pick while an assistant jerked the resilient material back and forth. The resultant holes, Thornton said, had been perfectly cylindrical, with no elongated tearing around the edges. Brian Murtaugh was handling the cross-examination of Thornton. What, he asked, had been the resilient material around which Thornton had wrapped the experimental cloth? Ham, Thornton said. Murtaugh had neither the personality nor the courtroom experience to feign amazement in the histrionic manner of Bernie Siegel. His astonishment was genuine. Ham, he said. You took a piece of ham? Like in a ham sandwich? Ham, Thornton explained, provided the closest possible replication of a human body in terms of its ability to absorb the impact of a thrust. Ham, Murtaugh repeated, walking away from the witness toward the prosecution table, shaking his head. Some of the jurors began to smile and even titter. It had not been sliced ham, of course, but a whole ham. Still, ham is ham, and no matter how earnest and erudite John Thornton appeared from that point forward, and his credentials were impeccable, his intelligence above question, his reputation in his field beyond reproach, the image that lingered was of this bearded Californian, with utmost seriousness, wrapping a piece of cloth around a ham and calling that a scientific experiment. It was an image which cast a very slight shadow indeed upon the stark, expansive landscape of Paul Stambaugh's earlier testimony. At the prosecution table, Murtaugh opened a briefcase and took out a blue pajama top. It was not Jeffrey McDonald's, but it was the same shade of blue and made of material similar to the top McDonald had worn on the night of the murders. Wordlessly, Murtaugh removed his suit jacket and wrapped the pajama top around his wrists, binding his hands. He was standing directly in front of the jury. With almost cat-like quickness, Jim Blackburn, who had sat silently throughout the entire cross-examination of Thornton, picked up the ice pick that had been used in the McDonald murders 9.5 years before. With Bernie Siegel apparently too astonished even to object, Blackburn lunged at Murtaugh and began slashing at him with the ice pick. Using the pajama top as a shield, Murtaugh deflected the blows. That is, he deflected all but one. That one made a small cut in his right arm. Now Bernie Siegel was on his feet. "Do you need a doctor, Mr. Murtaugh?" he said, gesturing toward Jeffrey McDonald. Murtaugh declined the offer of medical aid, though a secretary was dispatched to find a Band-Aid. When the laughter in the courtroom had subsided, Murtaugh held up the pajama top. Many of the holes were elongated, ragged cuts, not perfectly cylindrical punctures. Two persuasive points had been made. First, when a pajama top is wrapped around someone's wrists and used to fend off ice pick blows, the resulting holes will not be round and clean. Second, even in a brief, restrained courtroom demonstration, Jim Blackburn had been unable to avoid inflicting a puncture wound on Brian Murtaugh's forearm. Had it occurred to the jury to wonder why, in the course of a frenzied attack by intruders in a state of homicidal mania, no similar ice pick wounds had been inflicted upon the forearms of Jeffrey McDonald? Though there had been 38 punctures in the pajama top, which he said he'd had wrapped around his wrists, and which he said he had used as a shield. John Thornton described the courtroom demonstration as silly and rinky-dink. But John Thornton was not a member of the jury. With his perimeter overrun, and with even his inner lines of defense beginning to crumble, Bernie Siegel recognized that the time had come to rush a real mystery witness into the breach. Helena Stokely had saved him and Jeffrey MacDonald once before in 1970. Maybe she, or the invocation of her, could be made to do so again. First, Siegel subpoenaed Stokely's parents. Then Judge Dupree issued a bench warrant for Stokely herself on the grounds that she was a material witness in a homicide case. Stokely's parents came to Raleigh and said they did not know where their daughter was. The last time they had seen her was in early June, when she had come to Fayetteville for a brief visit from a drug rehabilitation center in Columbia, South Carolina. She had said then that she planned to move to the small South Carolina town of Walhalla, to live with a man whom she had met at the rehabilitation center. "I don't know her address," Stokely's mother said, "and I don't want to know." In a private interview with defense attorneys, the mother also said that even if her daughter were found, it was not likely she could contribute much of value to the trial. She called up, must have been a year and a half ago, 4 o'clock in the morning, all befuddled. She said somebody was chasing her and had taken her car keys. Then it turned out she'd had a stroke. We got her home. She was like a vegetable. She couldn't talk, couldn't eat. Her face quivered. Saliva would run out of her mouth. We put her on a strict diet and let her rest, and after about 3 weeks, she was improved. But still, she was not quite right. She had left home again, this time for Daytona, Florida, where she said she planned to work in a hospital. The next thing her parents had heard was that she had been arrested for drunken driving. "She's had her gallbladder removed," her mother said. "She's had 3 liver biopsies, and she's been spitting up blood and passing blood in her stools for years. She's not at all like she used to be. She's a physical and mental wreck. She's not even a human being anymore. You find her now, sure she'll talk. She'll always talk. But I'm telling you, she's going to talk all kinds of nonsense." Chain-smoking Virginia Slims cigarettes, Helena Stokely's mother described her daughter's original reaction to the murders. "It really hurt her. She was a very soft-hearted person, and she especially loved little children. She said right away, 'Not a hippie around here would do a thing like that. Everybody's going to pitch in and find out what happened. We've got to find out who did this.' I really believe it was Beasley who first put the idea in her head. Beasley was her daddy image. He had a terrific amount of influence over her. She told me he had been up to talk to her right after it happened, and then she said, 'Yeah, I've been thinking, and I don't really know where I was that night. I might have been there.' And I just knew right then that Daddy Beasley had talked her into it." Obviously, it would not suit the defense's purposes to put Helena Stokely's mother on the witness stand. But Bernie Siegel had assembled a cast of additional characters whose testimony seemed more likely to be useful. William Posey, the laundry deliveryman, Jane Zilieu, and another Nashville neighbor named Red Underhill, and Jim Gaddis of the Nashville Police Department, as well as the CID polygraph operator who had conducted the 1971 interview with Stokely, not to mention Prince Edward Beasley himself, now in retirement and eager to testify about how, 9.5 years earlier, Helena Stokely had joked to him about her ice pick and had said that, in her mind, she thought she might have been at 544 Castle Drive while the murders were being committed. Then word was received that Stokely herself had been located, hiding in the back of a trailer on the outskirts of Walhalla, South Carolina. She was immediately transported to Raleigh in the custody of federal agents. At 4 minutes before 10 o'clock on the morning of Thursday, August 16, 1979, exactly 1 month after the trial of Jeffrey MacDonald had begun, and 9.5 years to the day since Monday, February 16, 1970, a day which had ended with her taking mescaline in her driveway on Clark Street in Fayetteville, Helena Stokely, escorted by a U.S. Marshal, walked into a small office on the 9th floor of the federal building in Raleigh, where Bernie Siegel was waiting for her, hoping to persuade her to confess. She was neatly, even demurely, attired in white shoes and a floral print dress. Her hair was black, her complexion sallow. She was many pounds overweight. Her eyes were dull and her thin lips unexpressive. She spoke in a soft voice, almost entirely devoid of affect.
Her left arm was in a cast. It had been broken in Cincinnati 2 weeks earlier, when someone had hit her with a tire iron during a dispute involving narcotics. Her fiancé, Ernest Davis, whom she had met in the Drug Rehabilitation Center in Columbia, South Carolina, paced barefoot, unwashed and unshaved, in a small corridor outside the office. For almost a decade, in Bernie Siegel's mind, Helena Stokely had been a figure of near-mythic proportion. Now here she was, 3 feet from him, politely declining his offer of coffee and donuts. She would, she said, be grateful for a can of diet soda. Siegel began to speak in a voice so quiet and so gentle that it was as if Helena was sleeping and he did not want to risk awakening her. Yet there was an almost painful intensity to his tone. This woman, he believed, had the power to set Jeffrey McDonald free and to provide Siegel with the greatest triumph of his career. His first words were like surgical instruments. Utilized with the utmost skill and delicacy, they might enable him to stride forth from this room and announce to the judge and the jury and the press that there was no need to proceed further with the trial. One of the real killers had just confessed. Siegel had, at his side, an album containing photographs of the crime scene. He placed it on a table before Stokely. The first picture was not a particularly horrid one. All it showed was a portion of the kitchen of 544 Castle Drive. There was a calendar hanging on a wall. The top page of the calendar said February 1970. "See this, Helena?" Siegel said softly, leaning so close to her that he could have put his arms around her if he desired. "See that calendar? It has been there for 9 years, waiting, waiting for somebody to tell us how this story should end." She stared at the picture. There was absolutely no change of expression on her face. She took a sip of diet soda. "I can't help you," she said tonelessly. "I wasn't in that house. I didn't have anything to do with any of this." Bernie Siegel began to shake his head. "No, Helena, that won't do. You can't get away with that anymore. It's got to end. We are at trial now. The time has come. I'm serious, Helena. You were in that house. I know it, and you know it. Now let's talk about it. Don't go on punishing yourself." She stared at the floor, shaking her head, still with no change of expression. "I don't know what you want to know. I was never in that house." "Helena, believe me," Siegel said. "If you talk to me here, if you tell me what happened, I can make this very short and painless. Helena, you can put it behind you forever. Now, for your own conscience, and for the sake of that man in the courtroom, the man who has been made to suffer unjustly for 9 years. And Helena, you will not be prosecuted. Nothing will happen to you. That I can promise you. The statute of limitations has expired. This is the end, Helena. Right now, right here, all you have to do is talk to me." For the first time, Stokely looked directly at Bernie Siegel. "I can't help you," she said. "I can't tell you things I don't remember." For nearly 2 hours, Siegel persisted. His tone changed from soothing and protective to harsh and demanding, and back again. It made no difference. He might as well have been a morning quiz show. Stokely was tuned to his station, but she was only a viewer, nothing more. There was nothing he could do or say to move her. "Helena, people have gone to the electric chair for having said 1/10 of what you've said about this case. I've got 6 witnesses, people to whom you've already confessed. They're waiting in the next room. One after another, I'm going to put them on the stand and have them tell the jury what you've told them. Then, by law, I have to put you on the stand." She looked at him coolly, in silence. "Helena, the choice is yours." "I can't help you." "Helena, remember what you told Jane Sillieu?" the blood, I remember the blood on my hands." She shook her head. "I don't remember ever saying that." "Do you think Jane Sillieu is lying?" "I didn't say that. I just said, I don't remember saying that." Still, there was no inflection, no spark, not even of resentment, in her voice. Do you realize how much drugs I've taken since that happened? I'm not going to sit there and say yes to things I didn't say, or things I don't remember saying.